Okay, so we are. Before I begin and before I forget, let me start by saying thank you very much to our sponsors for this evening, Yaakov and Diane Burstein, who are sponsoring in memory of Yaakov's beloved father, Avram Burstein, Avram ben Moshe, Oliver Shalom, and to also to Stephen and Betty Nissenfeld, who are sponsoring in memory of Stephen's beloved mother, Sally Nissenfeld, Chaya Sarah Bat, Yeshaya Mordechai, Aleha Shalom. May their neshamot have aliyot, our learning is in their memory. May their memory be a blessing. I want to thank the Bursteins and the Nissenfelds very much. And I also just want to take this opportunity. I mentioned something in shul this morning to a different crowd, a smaller crowd. I just want to acknowledge the very difficult time that some of our fellow Americans and fellow Jews are having in different parts of the country now that are not really set up for the kind of temperatures they're experiencing. I've been in contact with colleagues in Texas today. In Houston, they seem to be okay. They're trying to figure out Shabbos meals for a lot of people. There have been a couple of plumbing issues, but they're under control. Dallas is having major issues. They're having hundreds of plumbers come down from kind of northern cities to come and help them, truckloads of things. It really is a crisis time. I think I saw a headline today that there are families who are using their children's wooden toys, burning them for heat in the home because they've got no other options right now. And it looks like another couple of days electricity is going to be on across the state. So we, of course, have them in mind in our learning and in our thoughts as well. And if I'm not incorrect, Abe, am I right? You have your site this evening for Lucille.
Yes.
Well, Neshama should have an Aliyah, and you should only
Libet
know
Sivya about
blessings.
Shmuel.
Tivya bat Shmuel.
Libet
Libet
Sivya
Sivya bat Shmuel.
Adar 7, like Moshe Rabbeinu. Easy date to remember.
Oh, that's true. Zion Adar, that's true.
Thanks
One
for
Neshama should have an Aliyah.
reminding. Appreciate that.
Cool. With that all said, and our thoughts all in the right place, we enter radically new territory today. So far, last week was already a major shift in terms of genre. We had the story of our exodus with all the drama that comes with split seas and misty mountains, not to quote Hobbit, from the revelation of the law. And then last week was essentially a overwhelming sense of what it means to be a civil society with criminal law, personal law, family law, a couple of societal laws, some ritual law. And then we shift gear again. And it is very difficult for all of us, but I can only speak for myself. As a rabbi who turns to the parasha each year, usually there's a new angle, a new episode, a new narrative that one can turn to. And now we hit the roadblock of basically four long parashas with a little break in the middle with some drama with a golden calf, but four long parashas describing, for want of a better term, the architectural blueprint of a structure. So in theory, we could go through the Aron Kodesh, some of the details. We could go through the menorah, the ketoret, some of the cloth and the curtains. And I think, oh, is this, am I not being heard clearly?
I hear you fine.
I hear you also.
Sim, I think it may just be
okay,
on your
so
end.
You're quite clear.
Okay, I'm sorry. I mean, often I'll just sit here talking to myself. So either way, I'll keep going. Right.
Your voice is clear. I can't speak to the ideas necessarily, but the voice is very clear.
Very funny.
I can probably speak to that. So, yeah. Well, we'll find out. We'll see where we end up.
Yes,
so,
we shall.
Next year, what I think I'll do is we'll turn to some of these items, and maybe over Shabbat, I'll turn attention to some of the design. But what I wanted to do today is addressed the very first pasuk of this week's parasha, almost by reverse engineering, through the back door of an entirely different subject, which is precisely on the subject of new territory. I'm going to share my screen with you so you know exactly what I'm referring to. And if you give me a thumbs up that you can see it, that will be a good start. Excellent. Yeah. So Parashat Truma, this is not the new territory, but I'll give you one guess what the next click of my mouse is going to put on the screen. New territory, headline today. Mars. I don't know how many of you saw this. Isn't it a relief to have news about something on another planet? There are no political parties. There is no strife between the populations. It's a quiet place. But you don't know that for sure. Say again?
You don't know that for sure.
That's true. That's part of what they're going to figure out. It could be it was a thriving planet that fell apart because of politics. We're going to find out. Maybe there'll be some political banners buried beneath the surface of the planet. We'll find out. But it is a remarkable thing to think that thousands and thousands of miles away, when I say thousands millions, of miles, millions. That's what I meant. I meant, sorry, millions and millions of miles, or thousands of miles away, you get to London. It does feel like a Martian to some degree. And I was considered an alien when I first arrived, but we have to get our terms straight. Millions of miles away, there are photographs being sent of a machine that was made in a laboratory here, landing. This obviously was not taken live at the landing. How do you know that? Because there wasn't a photographer on the planet taking a picture of the machine. That's the machine itself. So the first picture you got, say again.
How do you know?
That's true. The machine didn't take a picture of the man. There's a lot I don't know we're discovering.
It could be a selfie.
That's true. Maybe it had a selfie stick. And it did it, which is exactly what it did, but it was off the ground. And for some reason, the first picture wasn't in color, but I assume they'll work on that. But it's a remarkable thing. And it does give rise, with all these mysteries and the unknowns, it gives rise to a level of, I think, both excitement and a slight disquiet, at least for me, the possibility, the mere possibility that they may discover traces of life is tantalizing as a prospect for what we can discover about our own planetary events, history, what we can possibly use for the sake of scientific research. So it's tantalizing, and just in terms of the human frontier, it's tantalizing, but at the same time, it does breed a disquiet because that gives rise to all sorts of theological questions. There's life on another planet. I'm sure we'll all turn to the Midrashim and dig them up that discuss that God created worlds and worlds before he created this world. But I think even that's a Midrash. That's not in the Torah. What does the Torah have to say about another planet? The possibility there was life there. The possibility, I'll share the next screen with you, that not just there was life there, but what about the possibility, as Elon Musk hopes, that someday there will be life there, that their ambition, which is not science fiction, although it is far in the future, is to the road to making humanity multiplanetary. So what do we do theologically, halachically with these questions? It could be that instead of going to Florida in the winter, we go to Mars in the winter, and we all have a much shorter Shabbos because the rotation is quicker. But what do we do with it? Abe, you've got a question?
No, the Torah mentions the Nephilim, and I believe one of the commentaries says these were extraterrestrials. Isn't that correct? The Nephilim? They fell from the sky from another world.
So Abe raised an interesting point right at the beginning of Bereshit, which it usefully falls out right after Simchat Torah. Sometimes there's an overlap, sometimes there isn't. There's so much to talk about in Bereshit, we managed to avoid talking about the lesser understood segment. And there is a description of these Nephilim, which, how would you translate the word Nafal?
Fell.
Fell or fall. And there are some who suggest that this actually inspired the Christian tradition of fallen angels. that there were angels who rebelled against God and then fell, and they ended up on earth, and then it speaks about them abusing the children of man. So some suggest they are fallen angels. The movie that came out with Russell Crowe a few years ago about Noah and the flood, I think they just called it Noah, creative title. They had these kind of stone mechanical creatures, very odd reading of what the Nephilim are. And Abe has this suggestion that there are commentaries that see them as extraterrestrials, which I guess anything not from Earth is extraterrestrial. Yeah, we don't really know what to do with that. And I'm certainly not an authority on what that means. But there are certainly hints that we are in a state of mystery. And just because we don't know about it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I think it was actually 2 months ago, an ex-Mossad agent gave an interview and it made a headline, at least on my feed, it was a headline. But he said, there are clearly extraterrestrials. We have evidence of it. They've contacted us. And of course, the American president knows about it. Everybody knows about it. And the major problem in his story, no one believed him because nobody believed that Donald Trump would know about this and not tell anyone. So that was the main argument against believing him. But just because we don't know about it doesn't mean it's not the case. And we can bring up a list of times that human beings have made errors, mistakes, have harmed other people because they were confronted with new knowledge they weren't prepared to accept and saw it as a source of heresy. Now, there are boundaries to what we can think, might think, but what do we do about space, the possibility of a world beyond? And my hope is to explore very briefly this question, and then through this question, maybe have a look again at the first pasuk of this week's parasha. And the way to
doesn't the Kabbalah reference parallel universes?
Kabbalah
simultaneously, yes, with ours?
Well, I tell you what, officially, I'm not allowed to do Kabbalah till I'm 40. So you're going to have to wait a couple more years till I can admit that I know anything about it. But there are references to different olamot. It tends to be the implication of different mystical layers of life, different spheres. We say Hashem Hu Elokim 7 times at the end of Yom Kippur because the Shekhinah recedes from different spheres of existence. Traditionally seen as 7 different spheres, and then the eternal Ein Sof, the infinitude beyond. But it's certainly unclear what is meant by that. So let's take this back a few stages. Before we talk about being multiplanetary or parallel universes, let's focus on a straightforward question, which certainly can be done because it has been done. Now, I wasn't around in 1969, but I imagine some of your grandparents were, so you'll know what I'm talking about. And in 1969, for most people, human beings were known to have landed on the moon and planted an American flag then. For those of you who aren't a follower of Transformers, it was not a secret mission to beat the Chinese to spy technology. It was to put a flag on the moon to show what human beings can do, inspired, of course, by the vision of JFK, who said, by the end of the decade, we will put man on the moon. And let us see how this became controversial. A prayer, part of the liturgy that we say, usually in a stupor of some sort, because Shabbos is over, we've had our fill of food, we've had to sit through a shiur from the rabbi, we've davened Mara, we want to get home. Oh, it is Levana, let's go outside, it's a new moon. And as part of the tefillah, we say the following words. When we say the bracha at the beginning of Kiddush Levana, there is a tradition, a minhag, not to look at the moon while saying it, because we don't want to give the impression that we're somehow praying to the moon or worshipping the moon. So we find the moon, we see it, and then we turn away, we say the bracha, and then we can look at the moon again. And we say, Kishem Sha'ani Roked Kenegdecha, just as I, Roked meaning, what does Roked
dance
mean?
Dance.
Dance before you, just as I dance before you. And this is the point where you'll sometimes see people doing Kiddush Levana when they start hopping on their feet. I'd not seen that done when I was growing up. And when I got, and I hadn't seen that done in Israel either. But when I got to New York and I got to YU and I saw a group of people doing Kiddush Levana, I didn't know that's what they were doing. I just looked out the window one night and saw a bunch of people hopping up and down in the street. Thought there was a party. I didn't know what was happening. They were doing Kiddush Levana. And they say, just as I danced before you. And this is the key phrase. Ve'eini yachol lingaba. And I cannot touch you. Just as I danced before you, moon, but I cannot touch you. Ach, so too. In the same way, lo yuchlu kol oivai lingabi lara, may my enemies be unable to touch me for evil. So in 1968, when there was talk of man getting to the moon, a number of communities raised the question, are we going to be able to say this post-1969? Man has been to the moon. How can I say, just as I can't touch you, may my enemies not touch me? We're touching the moon. What am I to do with this liturgy? A number of might have said, calm down. But there were serious reactions given by a number of different rabbinic scholars to this phrase that saw it have a sense of urgency. And the truth is, the instinct to say, calm down, relax, almost suggests that we shouldn't take the liturgy too seriously. And there, these responses give the suggestion that liturgy is a serious doctrinal endeavor. The words that we say, we mean. And if I'm turning to the moon and I'm saying, God, I pray with sincerity and authenticity, please, just as I can't touch the moon, may my enemies not touch me. Does that become hollowed out by human discovery? So here are a couple of the responses, and some of them are surprising. I'll ask you, actually, what response might you give? Someone came to you in 1968 and said, what are we going to do if humankind lands on the moon? How can I still say, don't touch me, enemies, just as I don't touch the moon? What would you say?
A metaphor.
Okay, so Leo's solved the whole problem. Like, everybody calm down, not because the liturgy shouldn't be taken seriously, but it's a metaphor. So what do you mean it's a metaphor? Meaning it's a turn of phrase?
It just represents something that is intangible or unlikely to ever be true or real.
Interesting. So Leo suggests that we should really... relax our literal lens on this text and say it's not really talking to the moon, but it's saying, just as there are things in the cosmos that I can't reach, may my enemies not reach me. And it's not meant to be taken that literally. We shouldn't be that precise. We shouldn't hanker on each term. So that's a way out. So let's see the route some others took. This is the route that the Tshuvot written by Achaim Vahashalom, whose name I don't recall, but he was writing in the 1960s. And he said as follows, and this was his response to people saying, what about the news that we might land on the moon? He said, Ein v'divrehem plum. Don't worry about it. Calm down. Not because we don't have to take the liturgy seriously, because we don't have to take these scientists seriously. We're never, ever going to get to the moon. Don't be ridiculous. It's all fancy, a fantasy. It's never going to happen. Dimayon ba'alma. It's just sheer imagination. You think we're going to land on the moon? You're insane. Of course we're never going to land on the moon. He obviously had to print a retraction or endorse a conspiracy the following year. But in the meantime, he claimed that we can't possibly land on the moon. Why not? Shahari hila mala medal jesoda. Because the cosmos is made up of different elements, and beyond the atmosphere, it's just a vacuum. There's nothing there. What's the medieval term they would use to say what filled up space?
Ether.
The ether, right? Which is why we call sometimes things ethereal, meaning superhuman or unnatural or extra human. So this ether is beyond. But the four foundational elements, fire, wind, water, and earth, which sounds like I might be about to launch Power Rangers, earth, fire, water, earth. I don't know how many people watch that. Asei Kodesh Baruch Hu Ba'olamo Gvul. He says, look, God makes a fence, a boundary into the cosmos. V'chol echad v'echad. We've all got limits. We've all got bounds, places we can and can't go. And we should focus our energies where we can. And if we go beyond the bound we're meant to go, we will be burned up. Don't change the bracha. Don't worry about it. Don't spend another second thinking about it. It's an impossibility metaphysically. If we try to leave the atmosphere, we'll just be destroyed. Obviously, to some degree, the Hachaim v'Hashalom had to swallow these words. I will say that what some of us may view as distasteful reappropriation, some suggested when the Israeli astronaut tragically lost his life, they pointed to this and said, look, we were told that if you try to do these things, this happens, which of course was distasteful to many. Remind me his name, Ilan Ramon. And actually, I remember it kind of been that long ago that this occurred, maybe 15 years ago, maybe a little less. Ilan Ramon was in space. I remember when the tragedy happened and they didn't make it back to Earth, and there was a commencement in one of the high schools near where I was in London. My parents were there for some reason, and the guest speaker, rabbi, came and said, and he tried to basically make a nice point about focusing on the children and the future, but the way he expressed it was taken quite badly by the audience. And actually, he got kind of booed a little bit, jeered by the audience, because he said, everyone's focusing on what's going up in space. Who cares about what's going on in space? We care about what's going down on Earth, which, again, people say, you know, somebody representing Israel who made Kiddush in space and did other things representing all the Jews on Earth died. You don't say, you know, who cares? But this was an attitude at the start that is an impossibility. Now,
hi, it's Javi.
The next response came from Rav Goren. Now, Rav Goren was not a backward-looking figure who was resistant to change in many ways. He was the forefront of changes on the political front and elsewhere in Israel. He suggested that actually, let's look back in history and see if we can update the tefillah. He says, how can we possibly, this is post-1969, how can we possibly still keep using the liturgy that we've had? It is just impossible, Shekirish Levana. It doesn't make sense. We are touching the mood. And this is his response. He says, actually, if we look back to the earliest formulation of the prayer of Kiddush Levana, it's in one of the minor tractates called Masechet Sofrim, which is just after the Talmud was codified. And what was the original formulation? It was, Kishem Shani Roked Kenegdeth, just as I dance before you, Ve'eini Nogeaba, and I don't touch you. Not I can't, but I don't touch you. So he says, let's just change, go back to the original. Let's go back to a point where we're not claiming we can't touch the moon, just that I'm not touching the moon. And maybe we should amend the text, which of course, if you think going to space is going to be a problem for those who lean to the right, changing the nusach is even worse. So how can you possibly suggest that? And this is not the only time he suggested amending the Nusach, also when it comes to Tisha B'Av Nachem, which is inserted in the Midah. Yerushalayim was recaptured. Rav Goren was a key part of that endeavor. So he suggested making certain changes to the Nusach, and he did this often. He said, our Nusach, our liturgy, our prayers, the words that we say as we reach out to heaven have to reflect reality. We can't live in a separate sphere, detached from our lives when we're in conversation with God. So let's update it. And here he says, it's not even radical. We're going back to the way it was. And he says, Tadai lahaskir, it's worth noting, Jahagra mivilna, that the Vilna Gaon is imetzlot hanusach. He changed the nusach too. And he went back to the original. Now, why did the Vilna Gaon, change the nusach back to the original in the 1700s? Would you guess? Because he likes the original. He's a gra. He can do whatever he likes, and he likes the original. But what the Rav Goren suggests is, kinyireh, we have to assume, shebechazono hagadol, that with his great vision, hirgish b'chashivito shel hashinui, the gra understood that this is unsustainable formulation to the liturgy. It's not going to last forever. He's suggesting that the gra understood that someday we're going to make it to space. We're going to land on the moon. There's going to be an issue here. I'm going to forestall this. by making it not look reactionary, and I'm going to change the Nusach now. And the truth is, it's quite possible the Vilna Gaon did have that sensibility. He was not living in 1200. He lived in 1700. The scientific revolution was well underway. Newton, Galileo, of course, had made his observations. Newton had made his observations. The Enlightenment was about to kickstart into action. Universities were raging in the sphere of science, archaeology, chemistry, physics. It was not a huge feat of vision, though it was in the Jewish context, to suggest maybe we ought to amend this Nusach so that we don't have issues down the line. So we've had two responses so far to what are we going to do with this Nusach? One response was, don't worry, we're never going to land on the moon. That response has become somewhat defunct. And certainly if we're going to go to Mars, we're going to have some other questions. But Rav Goren says, so change the Nusach and don't say, I can't touch the moon, but I'm not touching the moon. Which raises what question? Where might you not be able to say Kiddush Levana?
The moon.
On the moon. If you're on the moon, maybe you can't say Kiddush Levana. And the truth is, it makes sense. Because if you're on the moon, when's the new moon? You're on the moon. So it's not like it changes in your vision. And there was actually a pamphlet put out about the halachot of space. I think Chabad put it out. They commissioned someone to write it up. How often, when do you say Shacharis on the moon? Do you follow the rotation of the moon? Do you calculate Shabbos every 7 rotations? Do you have to base it on Earth? What if it's a fast day and you're in the middle and you're like, all sorts of interesting questions, which may someday become applicable. But for now, say again.
When they open the Chabad house.
They've already opened the Chabad house. They're just waiting for visitors. That someone's been sitting there for 30 years. Yeah, that's true. There'll be questions about which Hechsher you can use in the Chabad house.
There is already one on the moon.
Yeah. What's it called?
There is one. There is a Chabad house on the moon.
I think you're joking.
No.
Right. They're taking bookings, at least. That's what I'm told. They're taking reservations, and they'll refund if you don't like the meal when you get there. So we've had two responses so far. The third response is an intriguing shift that would be a logical, I guess, extension of our first reaction. And this is Rav Shmuel Tovia Stern, who was actually in residence in Florida. He lived in Florida, relatively near Cape Canaveral. Anybody been to Cape Canaveral or Cape Kennedy, they call it sometimes, where they've got the launch pad?
Yes.
It's an amazing place to see. I managed to go there, a privilege to go there with family when we're in Florida. An amazing place to see the, they've got obviously displays of some of the out of use. Early. Say again?
Early.
Thank you. Some of the early air spacecraft, the spacesuits. Some of the greatest discoveries that we use all the time were essentially a result of space. Anyone use cling film? I think you call it something else here. What do you call it?
Saran wrap.
Saran wrap, right. That essentially was a result of research into how to keep things together in space. We may have come to it anyway. But there are all sorts of discoveries that were made. I'm sure many of you have heard how the Americans spent millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars on making sure that they could have a ballpoint pen that would work under zero gravity in space. And what the Russians did. Anyone know what the Russians did? Yeah.
They used a pencil.
They took a pencil. Yeah. But either way, it's worth the research and the discovery. But this is what Rav Shmuel Tovia Stern said. That in Yachol, when you say, I can't is an ambiguous phrase. If someone comes up to you and says, could you do me a favor? Could you do something? Can you fiddle with my taxes? You could say, I can't. What do you mean when you say I can't?
Won't.
Well, you might be saying I won't. But you say, no, I won't would mean I won't. If you say I can't, what do you mean? You might still do it. But you're saying I can't. What do you mean?
I'm not able. I don't know how.
Right.
Okay, so those are two different terms. I can't might be I don't know how, or I can't might mean I can't legally do that. Of course I can if I want to. It's kind of like when you're sitting at the table and someone says, can you pass the salt? And you say, yep, But okay, I know you can pass a soul. Could you please pass? All these terms are ambiguous. And he says, when we say in Kiddush Levana, Eini achol lingovach, I can't touch you, lav davka bilti yacholet mamashi. That's not saying I don't have the physical ability. I can't touch you, moon. And just as I can't touch you, my enemies not touch me. But bilti yacholet chuki. What's chuki? Legal. I don't have the legal ability to touch you. What we're saying is to the moon is, just as I am legally prohibited and I can't touch you, so too may the laws of nature prohibit my enemies from touching me. So what is he saying? He's saying, based on the liturgy of Kiddush Levana, it is prohibited to do what?
Go to the moon.
Go to the moon. And he's now going to extend that and say, it is forbidden to go to space, presumably on the basis of Kiddush Levana. He says, I can't touch you, moon, because I'm not permitted. And he says, this turn of phrase is used actually just a couple of weeks ago in the laning. At Mamad Har Sinai, it said, Lo yuchal ha'am la'lot del Har Sinai. The people could not come up to the mountain. Of course they could. There wasn't an irrepressible mystical force. They were told they're not allowed to, so they could not go up. And al pi asfarat halalu yeshloma, and you could say, if you're going by this logic, that it's prohibited to go into space, is surah kamash b'lam b'nei she'esh ashrat shechina b'elyonim. And talking about the mikdash, the mishkan that we'll be talking about in this week's parasha, there are places that we are prohibited from entering, that there are spheres, and this is similar to what Chaim B'Hashanah was saying. He suggested it's a physical impossibility because of the laws of nature. What Rav Stern is saying is, It's halachically prohibited. It's the laws of Jewish life that stop me from going there. I'm not allowed to go into the heavens because kimi v'sachak yarachla. This is the place of God. It's a kodesh, for a sanctity. So he's not saying it's a waste of time. He's saying the celestial sphere is the domain of God, and we have no right to go there. We're prohibited. And then he adds a detail for any of you who have been to the Museum of Natural Science. And since maybe we shouldn't touch the moon, maybe if they bring down moon rock, you shouldn't touch it. Have you ever seen moon rock?
Mm-hmm.
Where do they have it? I've seen it somewhere. It's
Museum of Natural History.
History.
I think it's in the Museum of Natural History. Right. So they've got a piece of moon rock there. So he suggests maybe there's a halachic prohibition on touching it. Maybe, based on this principle, that if I'm going to say Kiddush Levana, Eini Yachol Lingovach, I can't touch you, I shouldn't be touching the moon. So if you want to have another Chumrah when you're going to the Museum of Natural History, make sure to tell everybody, don't touch the moon. That's Rav Stern's suggestion, and it is a radical view, that he would say that Elon Musk is engaged in essentially prohibited activity. If we were living in a halachic mandate, in a halachic state, we would shut down SpaceX. That's what he's saying it is prohibited to go into space. We can develop technology for all sorts of research and discovery and endeavor here on Earth, but we are not allowed to leave the Earth's atmosphere. That would be his suggestion. And the truth is, while it may sound like a block on expanding the human frontier, to some degree, if you take this to its logical conclusion, and at some point, I guess we can do a series on a Jewish law, Jewish thought, and environmentalism, and climate change, and the reaction of halachic texts and rabbinic texts to that. The result of Rav Stern's premise is not just you should hamper discovery, but this is your home. Don't think for a moment, don't watch Interstellar and think you can just relocate humanity and become a multi-planetary species. Earth is your home and you've got responsibility for it as a species, and you can't leave. Legally, you are bound to be here and cultivate and protect the planet that you were given. That's what Rav Stern seems to be suggesting. And again, Elon Musk would be shut down if we were running a halachic state through the lens of Rav Stern.
Question. Rav Stern squirm anytime you took a plane?
Anytime you plane. So it's a good
He's
question.
He's getting a little close.
Yeah, he made sure they didn't go above 50,000 feet. So actually, in his piece, He does discuss aeroplanes, and his aeroplanes are fine. It's still in the atmosphere. It's not in what we call the celestial sphere. You're by the clouds. But he says, if you get into that space where you leave the Earth's atmosphere, that's where the divine presence is, and that's where you shouldn't go. And the truth is, it is, thinking about it, incredibly destabilizing. Imagining going into space. I don't know how many of you saw the movie, I think it had Sandra Bullock in it, called Gravity. That was, in many ways, it was spectacular visuals, but it was also quite nauseating to imagine having no center of gravity. And he suggests that we need to be grounded. Sol's point is well taken. We can fly in the same way that I'm allowed to jump. He would suggest you don't have to have your feet literally on the ground, but Earth's atmosphere is the outer limit of our permissible range. That's his suggestion. So we've had three responses so far. The first response was, don't worry about it. You're never going to make it out there. The second response was, we need to change and amend the text to make it less problematic, but there may be repercussions. You can't say it on the moon. And the third response was, of course, in theory, we can make it to the moon. We know we can. We've seen it. We saw Neil Armstrong land on the moon, but we shouldn't be doing it. It is anathema to our religious culture, to our religious spirit. That's his claim. And I wouldn't say he's alone. There were figures, traditional religious figures at the time, not just in the Jewish faith, but elsewhere, that suggested that this was somehow an affront to the celestial dominion of God. So he wasn't alone by having this, we could call it a conservative perspective, lowercase c, in that we have to remain where we are. And the truth is, it leads to the need for conservation of this planet, because we don't have an alternative. Now, while it's being raised that are we allowed to go to space, if any of you are thinking, I think I saw Virgin Galaxy is selling tickets for the next trip into space. I think it's, $1 million a ticket? And if you're looking to take a guest.
That's without meals.
That's without meals, right? Right. Well, if you are looking to take a guest, I'm not going to volunteer first. I'm not going to be the first one to sit on that, because they keep blowing up, which is precisely what the Mishnah Halachot has to say about this. He says, "Bedavar she'al tovim mutar li'Yisrael la'alot al ha'lvana." People have asked me, are we allowed to go to the moon? He says, "Asur." It's prohibited for two reasons. And these seem to be relatively straightforward. Chada, number one, davim makom sakana. It's dangerous. We're not allowed to endanger ourselves. In fact, I heard, and this is not me issuing a psak, so nobody get nervous, but I heard one of the Rosh Yeshiva at YU saying, if anybody ever asked him if they're allowed to go skiing, he says, no, you're not allowed to go skiing, because people hurt themselves regularly. It's like a fact of skiing that, you know, just a proportion of the time you end up with a broken bone. I don't know if that's true statistically. I've been skiing once and I nearly hurt myself, so I guess I could serve in the study. But that was, we've all seen over the last year that in Jewish law, there is a prohibition on endangering ourselves to the extent that we're going to close shuls, we're going to keep distance, we get all sorts of things we do in order to keep ourselves safe. And he'd suggest, if we're going to close shuls so that we can't endanger ourselves now, why on earth would you go to space? It's incredibly dangerous. And he says it's dangerous for two reasons. Number one, it's dangerous for two reasons. Number one, ha'aliyah. Making aliyah is dangerous. What do you say? Making aliyah? I mean, liftoff is dangerous. There's always a huge amount of tension around the countdown for liftoff, either because there could be mechanical failure and it doesn't work and nothing takes off, or because there's a huge amount of combustion going on that could be incredibly dangerous. And often liftoff doesn't go well. Even today, liftoff isn't always guaranteed to be successful. He says that's one reason. And number two, Ashenich, Hashihia Sham, being in space is dangerous. Anyone saw Tom Hanks in Apollo 13? That was a close, was it Apollo 13 or Apollo 11?
13.
That was a tense moment. Houston now having their own problems. That was tense. Sham She'ein Sham Avish Ra'u L'Bal Chai. If something goes wrong in space, you're in trouble. You can't wind down the window. Sol might jump in here and say, well, if something goes wrong in a plane, you also can't breathe. You can't roll down the window there as well, which I think is a reasonable point. Although I guess they have parachutes and there are means to, you can't put on a parachute and jump out of a spaceship. Nothing's going to happen.
What about when going in airplanes weren't so common when they first started? It was dangerous.
So I think you're absolutely onto it here, which is he set up a contingent prohibition, which is if it becomes statistically safe and routine, the prohibition seems to disappear, at least half of it. The idea that if you're in space and something goes wrong, you're in trouble. There may be ways to mitigate that, I guess, over time, if they develop some sort of oxygen tank supply that you could wear and, you know, people wander around in space all the time. But certainly liftoff, if it gets to a point where it becomes routine, I think that would be a weaker argument to say you shouldn't do that. Like Sarah's saying, planes taking off used to be, you know, a tense moment. And some of us get kind of butterflies in our stomach as takeoff's happening still, but it's statistically, it's less dangerous than, you know, starting your car, as they like to say, statistically speaking. I think you're right. There is a suggestion, at least in this logic, that it may become less problematic. Now, I see time is marching on. So luckily, we're getting to our final view, which is Rabbi Soloveitchik, which in some ways is a version of what Leo suggested at the start. Pshita says, this is obvious. Everybody should calm down about this question, that we're all getting into a pretzel because of the Kiddush Levana, that we say, I can't touch your moon, and now you're thinking about, maybe you're not allowed to go into the space, maybe we need to change the text, what are we going to do? Says, everybody calm down. Kavanato, all it means is, she'achshav, that right now, b'shah she'anu omrim b'ilchat Kiddush Levana, that as I'm saying it, v'ragleinu omdot al gabei ha'karek al tevan, I'm standing here, I can't touch the moon. Anybody standing doing Kiddush Levana, you try to touch the moon, it's not going to work. It's too far away. And that's all it means. Now, that's very similar to some degree to the end result of Rav Goren, but Rav Soloveitchik says in his lowercase c conservative style, you don't even need to amend the text to make sense of it. Saying, I can't touch you means I can't touch you here. I don't need to change the text. And what I would add that I didn't have time to put on the slide for you is a passage from Lonely Man of Faith, where Rabbi Soloveitchik takes exactly the opposite attitude to Rav Stern in terms of technology discovery in the human frontier, where he writes in explicit terms about improvements in air flight going from New York to London, New York to Australia, suggesting that actually the more we do as human beings, the more we discover, the more we employ, the more we experiment with, the more research we make, the more evidence we uncover about the cosmos, the more dignified we become as human beings, the more power we can exert. And by having more power and more dignity, we are echoing the image of God. And that's where we should be headed and embrace every opportunity. And when we say HaShamayim, Shamayim La Hashem, we're talking in some metaphysical sense. It doesn't mean we can't go there. That's Rabbi Soloveitchik's view. And this was my back door to this week's parasha, which we'll finish off in the next minute, which is right at the beginning. Gabel b'nei Israel v'yikhu li truma. God says to the children of Israel, says to Moshe rather, speak to the children of Israel v'yikhu li truma, and take for me a gift. That's what you should say to the children of Israel. And it's a very strange turn of phrase to say v'yikhu li truma, take for me a gift. How would you usually say, if you wanted someone to get a gift, what would you usually say? What verb is it?
V'yitnu.
V'yitnu li truma, and give me a gift instead of a take for me a gift. And there have been multiple different readings of this, but I'll share just one from the Givat Shaul, Rabbi Saul Levi Mortiera, who suggests that the root of truma, resh vav mem, Rome. What is Rome? Not the city, but what is the root? Rome? Romamut? Romamut is right. It means elevation or transcendence. We could translate it as majesty. Romamut Hashem, when we speak about the transcendence, the majesty of God. And his suggestion here is that what God is saying to the people is, v'yikhu li truma, take from me, not give to me, but take from me my Romamut. Meaning over the last few weeks, you have experienced God in the most remote, mysterious, indecipherable sense as a figure who manipulates the cosmos without rational reason, without comprehension. Plagues have been flying. Animals have been responding to my call. Mountains have quivered. Oceans have split. Empires have fallen. What I need for you to do, you can't sustain a relationship with God like that. I need you to take some of my transcendence away. And that's why I need you to build this home, to have you have me in your midst. God needs to be a part of human life if it is to be sustainable as a long-term project and relationship. And to some degree, that's what this effort is, to expand the human frontier, to v'yichu li truma, to find, not to take away God's transcendence by undermining God's presence, but to find God in our lives. And that means if we go to Mars and it blows our mind, that should increase our contact with godliness, that God has forged a cosmos. And this Mars that we're standing on or we're looking at is not a distant ethereal planet that we just gaze at in awe and reverence, but it's something we can touch with our hands, and we can feel the divinity of the Creator in all that we do. So with that said, if we do make it to Mars one day, I'm sure we'll have a series of questions to ask. And next year, we'll have a closer look at some of these Kalem in more detail. But it struck me, those images today of the Perseverance landing on the surface of the planet. And I thought it might be worth turning our attention to that. And we've had a couple of these inspired moments. A few months ago, we had what happened a few months ago? The astronauts... We had liftoff where they went, did they go to SpaceX. The moon?
SpaceX went to the space station.
The space station, that was it. Thank you. And we had the International Space Station open up, and we had the different astronauts come together, and they took 17 hours to get there, came straight back. Yes, thank you. So we've had a couple of moments where quite a lot of what's been happening on the surface of this planet has been somewhat tense the last year. And to have the chance to look up and think about the future possibilities has been... uplifting, and a chance to infuse divinity and the larger cosmos in our lives, but not in a way that distracts from our humanity, but actually in a way that brings us together. And that's why the International Space Station was so meaningful, because it was a chance to see different nations that are clawing it out on Earth, collaborating and coming together. So I'm not running anywhere, but I do want to free you. And thank you very much for your contribution, attention, thought. I want to thank again our sponsors this evening, and wish neshama and aliyah, neshamot aliyot, and you should all keep warm, keep safe, keep healthy, and I wish you all well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Thank you. Thank you.